Hey everyone. We're doing this a little different today. Before we get into our interview with Sean Russell, there's just something important and tragic and shocking that that we need to discuss, or I feel that we need to at least say something about. And I'm sure most people listening are already aware. This show is Kevin and I both live in Southern Ontario, and 2 days ago, local activist Regan Russell was hit by a transport truck and killed at a vigil in Burlington, which is, I guess, kind of just right in the middle of between where Kevin and I are. I'm not even really sure what to say. It's hit our community hard. This slaughterhouse is in Burlington. I've been there many times, and there has been a history of the, I call them murder truck drivers being aggressive, and they've driven through activists, get out of the way. Sometimes they slowly go through, and sometimes they go a little quicker. And I felt like, one of these times just something's going to go wrong. I actually myself at Conestoga Meatpackers in Kitchener was almost hit once. I was standing in the road, and the driver actually sped up, and if I didn't move, would have hit me, would have killed me. And a lot of these drivers they're reckless, they're dangerous, and they drive through people thinking, they're going to get out of the way. And for whatever reason, Regan didn't. And I don't know. I don't really know what to say. I mean, I didn't know Regan personally. We had been at demonstrations together at the same time. I don't remember ever having an individual conversation with her, but she's someone from our community. She's an activist for 39 years. She just always fought for animal rights and human rights. And I guess that fits into today's episode too. I mean, she was someone I read that was arrested multiple times for civil disobedience for multiple causes of justice. So I just felt like we couldn't just do this episode and not say something about it, not address it in some way, even though I really have no idea what to say. Everybody, is still in shock. I've gone through, sadness, but then, anger. I'm feeling angry at the truck driver. I'm feeling angry at all the truck drivers. I'm feeling angry at the slaughterhouse for not having safety measures. I'm feeling really pissed off at the Halton Regional Police, who have known about this trend in violent drivers and really illegal actions, but have done nothing about it. And I'm pissed off, and I don't know exactly what we do from here, but I don't know. We gotta do something about this, because this can't happen. And there's multiple levels where people are responsible and could have done something to prevent this.
Well, I feel your pain, Ben, and it came at a time when the world is really suffering in lots of ways. We are still dealing with a worldwide pandemic. We are going through the greatest civil rights movement in our life. Black Lives Matter is all over the world at this point. People are protesting in the streets, and then a local activist, I have never met her. I had never met her as well. But I know she was extremely passionate, and she knew all the local activists. She had been there many, many times. She was a regular protester at the Meatpackers plant in Burlington, Ontario. And it's just not something we needed at this point. It just kind of,
didn't need to happen.
It didn't need to happen, of course. I want to say to Regan, if she's listening, thank you for your passion, and thank you for what you did. We're not going to forget you. We're not going to forget what you stood for. And we want to dedicate this episode to all those who have lost their life in the name of social justice. And today's episode is going to talk about racism and Black Lives Matter. We're less than a month after George Floyd lost his life. And today joining us is Sean Russell. No connection to Regan Russell. And we are going to discuss things that make us a little bit uncomfortable and hopefully push forward so that we can all, in the end, have a better world. So thank you guys for listening, and we hope you enjoy today's episode.
Welcome, listeners. I'm glad you are here.
The world should become vegan because at its core is the idea of being compassionate to all beings. And veganism allows you to take that general concept, that nebulous concept, and break it down into actionable steps. So veganism essentially becomes that blueprint for you to exercise compassion for all beings.
Welcome back to another episode of the Live Vegan Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Leahy, and we are joined by Ben Loa. One more time. What's up, Ben?
Hey, Kevin. How are you?
I'm doing great, except the world might not be doing as great as I feel right now. A lot has happened since our last episode.
Yeah. No kidding. But, you always want to look on the positive side, but this is a positive. The world is demanding change. So
for sure,
it's probably better than it was, you know, the last time we did an episode.
We've seen a lot of progress in the last month. We've also seen a lot of division and confusion. I think no matter how you define it, this is what we're witnessing right now, the greatest civil rights movement of our lifetime, for sure, Ben and I. And every major city in the USA has held repeated protests over several weeks now, and other cities in the world. And we want to sort this out. We want to talk about it together. We want to have a conversation that might make some people uncomfortable, but we want to explore it, what I would consider to be courageously and with open minds about where we are and where we're going with regards to systemic racism and this great movement called Black Lives Matter. So we have a guest joining us today, and his name is Sean Russell. Sean, thanks for being here. You've been called one of the leading voices in the South Florida vegan movement by the Miami New Times Magazine. You're an accomplished media producer with over 24 years of professional experience. You've worked with lots of nonprofits, school districts, and major brands. And you have an organization called SoFlo Vegans, which raises awareness about health, the environment, animal liberation, and spreading compassion. You also have your own weekly podcast called the SoFlo Vegans Podcast. So I will link all those things in the show notes. People can check out your page. So Sean, thank you for joining us. Thank you for being part of this conversation.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Love to have these sort of conversations.
Great. Well, we're excited that you were able to join us. And as our listeners know, this is a podcast that's typically about the vegan movement. And every episode we've had has been somehow connected to our movement, but this is something that we feel is just important enough on its own that we need to focus on. And so personally, I'm a 40-year-old white guy living in Canada. So my view of racism is just, you know, what I hear from people that have experienced it or just what I see, on the news. But I was just curious from your perspective, Now, I'm not sure how old you are, but maybe we're close to a similar age. But I was just wondering what, you know, has there been any progress? Is racism today what it was when you were a kid? Has it improved at all? Because, I mean, in my eyes, it just, there seems to be differences. But like I said, my eyes is a 4-year-old white guy.
Well, to answer your question, I'm 38 years old. Okay. And has racism improved or changed significantly since I was a child? To me, that's a complicated question, only because you are looking at different variables that are involved. One, the fact that you're a child. There might have been things that you weren't privy to at that time that might have been going on around you. So that's one thing. The other thing is the state of technology right now, the availability of seeing what's happening versus back then, you didn't even have you didn't even have internet on your cell phones. I was trying to give, you know, a little bit of credit to the 80s and the 90s, but no, we didn't have internet on our phones. So there are a lot of factors involved that maybe racism was the same back then. It's just wasn't as easy to see. For me personally, I would say I was blessed in the respect that I didn't personally experience any episodes that were traumatic to me. Most of what I experienced was through secondhand accounts, through television, just a constant reminder that my ancestors or people that look like me weren't created equal in the eyes of white people. And having to wrap my head around that, why that was even a thing, and why we aren't talking about it more. That was more of my experience. And in this conversation that we're having, I'm going to be very, very clear in saying I'm only speaking for myself. And hopefully someone listening to this can see a mirror in my experience, because not all Black people have the same experience. And that's another thing that sort of bugs me a little bit in these sort of dialogues and you know, getting asked questions about certain things, is I'm not clear if people understand that distinction. So, but these are all things that I carry around with me as a Black person, that even if I don't experience racism firsthand, it's always in the back of my mind, whether or not the exchange that I'm having with a person, if there aren't, you know, underlying racist tones there. And that's something that I wish I didn't have to experience. So to answer your question, has racism changed, gotten better, or you know, from back then? I'm going to say no, only because of where we are right now. Because if it did get better, it wouldn't have gotten so drastically out of hand right now.
And you said, why aren't we talking about this? That brings up an important point that Ben and I talked about before even booking this particular episode, and when we discuss things in general, just whether or not to talk about it at all versus speaking up, right? We're sort of torn, I guess, as white men. I'm also a 40-year-old white man living in Canada, for the record. You know, and I see speaking up as being really important, because I don't want to be silent and complicit. And I saw like the Me Too movement, where women were speaking up, and it was very important for men to speak up then, perhaps in some ways even more important. But then I am balancing that with, I don't want to hijack a movement that's not mine, and I don't want to make this about me. So I'm kind of torn. Do I speak up? Do I not speak up? And if I do speak up, how do I handle that?
I mean, I guess in response to that, I would say going to the Me Too movement, because that's something I feel we have an equal playing field on. Whereas I'm empathetic to the movement, and I know there's things that I don't understand. So what I'm careful not to do is to jump into the conversation without doing the research. So parlaying that to the Black Lives Matter and what's going on right now, what I would caution people to do that may not be black is to arm yourself with the knowledge before you jump into the conversation. Because what ends up happening, what I see and what I experience, is that people start carrying the banner, start carrying the flag, leading the charge, speaking up for black people. And it's different than being black and having to go through it and having to experience and internalize the struggles that our people have gone through on a day-to-day basis. You know, like, there's no break for us. There's no, okay, I'm going to go ahead and start focusing on this. I'm going to start watching Netflix now. It's always there, whether it's a commercial that pops up for a new movie about a slave revolt, or it's seeing a news clip about Aunt Jemima being taken off the bottles. It's always a constant reminder that triggers everything that I've experienced from the moment I could read until now, that we are essentially second-class citizens. Even worse than that, I'm making it very light and fluffy there, even till today. And yes, there's been some progress. There's been some movements that have gained some positive results. But what I've seen is that it's just shifted into something else. Like, slavery shifted into Jim Crow. Jim Crow shifted into redlining. Redlining shifted into, you know, the prison system, the drug wars, the Southern strategy. All of these different things, I feel that unless a person is privy to all of these injustices that have happened to black people, it's going to be a conversation where myself or other people are going to have to be giving you this education rather than focusing on what we can do to make this better for black people. Because I don't have the answers. I'm just dealing with what's coming up for me right now. You know, I've dedicated my life right now to the vegan community, to what we're doing here in South Florida, because I know at my heart, it's about compassion. It's about having compassion for myself, having compassion for others. And that's an ideal conversation to be had. I get to live in the real world where being compassionate to someone who's going to spit in my face and call me the N-word is something easier said than done. And I'm going to stop there because I feel like I'm going on for a while.
No, that's all right. I'm hanging on every word. I want to ask you about that education and how we get that education. Now, I'm a pretty inquisitive person. I ask a lot of questions. So that's how I learn. I ask people that have experienced it. I can't understand what racism is. So for me to understand it, I have to ask people in the black community or other races that have experienced racism. But that brings me to the question of labor, which I hear a lot about. People saying, don't expect black people to do the labor for you. And we're in a mutual group where we're introduced. And even when I asked the question about, we want to do a show about this topic, should we have someone on or should we just talk about it ourselves? And there were some people that said, don't expect black people to do the labor for you. Just talk about it yourselves. You guys should talk about it yourselves. Now, those were only white people that were telling me that. And there was many other people from the black vegan community that were saying, oh, you should definitely have somebody from the community on, and I would love to help, or I would volunteer to come on. So I know, like you said, you can't speak for the entire movement, but what's your interpretation of the labor as far as how we can educate ourselves?
Well, I touched on it a little bit. I mean, I didn't ask people questions. I looked for information. There's books, there's videos, there's a lot of things that are out there. I could see one of the challenges being not knowing where to start. So that I can understand. So in terms of you doing the work to have that conversation, I could interpret it as digging a little bit yourself instead of just asking somebody, seeing what you can come up with. And then in the conversation, you're now coming from a place of, from my understanding, from what I know, you know, instead of, and I'm not saying this is what you're doing, but instead of, and what happens commonly, all right, I want to be an ally. What can I do? Tell me about your experience. What is racism? I've experienced racism, but what, how have you, it's okay. I understand that I, you know, I'm familiar with the Tulsa bombing in Greenwood. I'm familiar with redlining. I'm familiar with a few things, but I know there's a lot that I don't know. At least it shows that you put some effort into being able to contribute to the conversation, because racism and everything that Black people have gone through isn't just a Black experience. It's a two-sided thing. So for us to really have a constructive conversation, we both need to understand the roles both of our and that's a gross assumption. Maybe your ancestors weren't from America and from other places, but in a general sense, what roles each of our ancestors have played, not from a place of now you get to own it and you get to be responsible for what they've done, but just from a place of reconciliation to say, okay, this has actually happened. Because another part of it is that it's not taught in the textbooks. It's not taught in the schools. And it's not the only case of things that aren't taught in school. So it's like going down a rabbit hole of seeing what you have, what's being withheld from you. And for me, I went through a phase in my life, like I mentioned, I'm 38 years old. I went through a phase of my life that I see a lot of the younger generation going through right now, the people that are out there marching, people that are protesting, that they're going through right now. I've experienced that. I've gone through that. I've held that in my heart, that pain in my heart. And I decided to shift that energy into what I'm creating rather than just make that fester inside of me. But recently, with everything that's going on, and I'm gonna credit, you know, being in quarantine and just the whole state of the nation right now, of this being this perfect stew of crazy, to say I can't operate on that wavelength anymore. I can't operate on, well, I understand this is a serious thing and I gotta focus on this. No, I get to do both. And that's where I am right now. And that's why I decided to have this conversation with you. Because in this conversation that I'm having with the both of you, I get to do both things. I get to share my voice with the world. And then I get to use my gifts to contribute to society as well as bring awareness. Hopefully, I'm hoping somebody's listening to this right now and is like, okay, wow. Well, I didn't know that. Or, oh, cool, I could do that. Or, oh, I have this thing. That's what I want to see happen.
What is white fragility? Because I keep hearing that being spoken, and I think it is something that's real, and it's making us, I guess, us uncomfortable to talk about it, and then we might be reluctant to learn in the first place or even have that conversation.
That's white fragility. Okay, so I'll say this. I don't know what the common definition of it is, but when I hear white fragility, what I hear is when these sort of conversations come up, it could potentially create a paradigm shift in the listener. And that is uncomfortable, to take your worldview and have it turned on upside on top of its head and then be expected to respond, or in some cases, be pressured to do things that may not be in line with the way you see the world. I see sometimes evoke a response that can come off as being insensitive to what that other person is experiencing. So that's why, in just seeing all these, like my personality type is, I'm more of an observer. Like if there's a fight going on, I'm looking at the mechanics of, okay, how many people are in the audience? Is anybody filming? What's going to happen after the fight? I'm not necessarily looking at the fight itself. So that's just how I move in life. And I've come to terms with that's who I am. So when this happens, I'm observing not what you're saying, but who you're being in a situation. And what I see is a need to solve what's happening right then and there. So, for example, somebody posts, a black person posts on social media, this is horrible, they need to go to jail, here's a video of a cop doing this, that, and the other. I may look at it like, wow, sis, I don't like the way I'm feeling with this. This is making me upset. And I understand that this person's pissed off. And I appreciate that this is being shared because there may be people who don't realize this is happening. Someone else, and this is actually things that I see, may look at it as, wow, this person has a lot of pain in their heart and they're upset. And that pain causes cancer and it adds to the collectiveness of the world being in dysfunction. And what you need to do is you need to forgive. You need to adopt a positive mindset. You need to focus that energy into improving your neighborhoods. And boom, right then and there, it's like, crap. Like, you're missing the point.
Yeah, because you're turning a blind eye almost consciously to the suffering that we need to be aware of, right? You can't ignore that.
And that's not to say I don't agree with some of what they're saying. Like, I personally know that, you know, the consumption of negative energy does impact your body and impacts your mind and impacts the way you do and move in the world. But at the same time, that's in a perfect world. In a perfect world where everyone was equal and, you know, I don't have to think about hypothetical situations of if I can go back in time to any period, where would I want to go and have to go all the way back to pre-slavery times to, you know, when our people were kings and queens as my first option. Because I know if I go back in the 60s, 50s, 40s, 30s, 20s, 10s, any time before that, I could possibly be lynched or killed, depending on where I land. They don't have to have that sort of thinking in their mind. So there's a certain level of empathy and awareness that comes with arming yourself with knowledge to see where this person is coming from. To know, okay, maybe this is not the moment where I tell you you need to align your chakras. And that's what I experience. And that's coming from a place of me having lived in that space of transformation and spiritual healing.
Sir, so, I just want to follow up on that. But like, what do you think is the biggest obstacle there to educating ourselves? Because you mentioned a feeling of discomfort and being very uncomfortable and your whole world being flipped upside down. Is the fear, when you really look at it at its core, just the fear of being wrong? The fear of knowing that throughout whatever period of time I was wrong?
No, for me it's not being wrong. For the other person?
Yeah, for the other people who are trying to accept it. I'm thinking of like white fragility and why people are reluctant to explore this in the first place and why they won't get into aligning the chakras? Sorry, I don't know.
Chakras, yeah. I was being flippant with that, but you know, that's what I hear. It's like, you know, and once again, this comes from a place of, I actually believe a lot of that stuff, but it's just not the time and the place. Timing is everything. Dichotomy, timing is everything. And if for me, and I always point back to me, it's very intentional because I can only speak for myself and my experiences and what I've experienced of other people. So I'm going to answer your question in a second. So I'm putting a quick pin on that. But for me, it's knowing as much as I could possibly know and knowing that there's more that I can know about the person that I'm speaking with so I can have an idea of where they're coming from. And I don't see that happening. I'm just going to say on social media, because that's mainly what I'm exposed to right now. I wish I could be in more close circles with people, but you know, you want to be cautious. I don't see that happening. Now, to your question, I'm pulling the pin out. To your question regarding whether it's them being, you said being wrong?
Just the fear of being wrong. I think it's what I would maybe boil it down to when I look at it from the perspective of why not engage in this conversation? You know, what's the fear? What are we afraid of? Why are we scared to even have this conversation and admit that racism exists? Admit that maybe we have racial biases and tendencies. What's the fear? Just of saying, hey, I was wrong this whole time. I guess I was being wrong.
I wouldn't say that. And I'm looking at my experience only because I wouldn't see it being that different from another person's experience. Because even like for women, the Me Too movement, you know, I'm taking that as an example just to kind of level the playing field a little bit. For me to know that this exists and then the world that I knew exists isn't true. In the back of my mind, that creates doubt that anything is true. And from that point, you start to unravel other things in your life and chaos starts to flip the balance. The balance between chaos and order starts to become out of line. So for me, it's like finding out, you know, about Christopher Columbus, finding about, you know, the truth about slavery and all that stuff. It's like, crap, you know, what else are you lying about? And so for me, it's there might be a little bit of being wrong there, but it's more about just losing control of the life you've created for yourself up to that point. And it took me a while to like just wrap my head around that. And this is younger. Like, I think after I went to college and I heard my first thing about Abraham Lincoln, you know, like some of the stuff he said on record about slavery. And that to me, it was like, and this was from a white professor. I'm like, what? Like, he's the great emancipator, you know? So I started to see questions. One question would lead to another question, to another question. I would get complete resources, books, video stuff. And then every year it's like, I would have a conversation with someone and then they would mention something. And so I'll just add all of these things over the last two decades where I come to a point of like, wow. And I'm open for anything not being real, you know? And I come from a place of like, okay, if it's not real, let's figure out what is. And how does that actually going to apply to what I'm up to right now? Because it's not just about the past. It's about, you know, what's being present and the future. And that's what I gather from even conversations like this. Like, all right, what's next? And how can I lead a life of being compassionate to others? So I'm grounded in my principles. And that helps me not like completely become a toxic individual.
All right. Well, I'm wondering where, for myself and for some of our listeners, where we should be looking for, like, who should we follow? What should we be reading to better understand this? I mean, I'll admit, like, I'm guilty. I haven't read enough about it. I mean, about racial issues. I've read some Cornel West and some Patricia Hill Collins, in university, but, you know, other than that, I haven't really dove too deep on this. It's mostly just social media and things I hear from people that I know. So who should I be following, you know, whether on social media or what are some authors whose books I should pick up and start reading to better understand and find out what is real?
Well, what I would say is, and this is going to be a very general thing that anybody should be able to do. Two things. One, focus on a topic. And in the last couple of days, last couple of weeks, you should be able to easily pick up on some topics. So a good place to get started would be Jim Crow, would be Reconstruction, would be this slavery, would be the Civil War. A lot of topics that you probably already studied in school. These are things that you will start seeing videos on, like Vox, a lot of different public 60 Minutes, a lot of mainstream publications have created History Channel. They have created information illuminating what actually happened. There are 13, the documentary on Netflix. That's a great documentary to watch, to learn more about some of the things I mentioned on this podcast, the Southern strategy, the drug war, a lot of these different things that have played an integral role on the Black experience up until today. What I would say is to shift the concept of Black oppression being limited to just slavery. And that's one of the counters I hear a lot. Well, slavery happened a long time ago. It's not just slavery. It's everything that I've mentioned. So I've listed a whole bunch of things right there. If you want to put it in a, you know, in the bulleted list so people can do their independent research.
For sure. Yeah. We'll link all those things.
You and because the other part of that too is all of these topics are grounded on things that actually happened. The difference is the person presenting the information. So there may be a person that you connect with a lot more than another person. You may want to hear, a scholar talk about it rather than a rapper. You may want to hear, so once you do the search off of these topics, you'll see different things that may pique your interest. But for the most part, the knowledge and the information that they're talking about is going to be similar across the board. It's just the package that is presented. So that's why I'm like cautious to like recommend individuals, because I may recommend somebody that may completely turn you off from even wanting to know more. And that doesn't help anybody. So do this research, find somebody that you feel you can connect with and watch it. And then from there, you may want to watch more. There may be something else that pops up and you may not like want to watch videos. Do a search for books. Just type books. So use Google, use YouTube, use any search engine and just search these topics and start somewhere.
Whatever you send us, we'll share with the audience for sure. Whatever you suggest. But I definitely understand the audience member has to connect with the individual who's presenting the information. I want to ask, I guess, an obvious question, I guess an obvious answer, but one that is just so common throughout social media right now. And I just have to ask, and I don't know if we cannot ask it, what is wrong with saying all lives matter at this point in history?
End of interview. Just kidding. I'm just kidding. All lives matter. No, it's cool. It's cool. All lives matter for me is, and I've seen a lot of memes, a lot of things happen that kind of explain it pretty well. It's like saying, I'm dating the podcast, but whatever. Let's take Father's Day. So we're posting Father's Day, and then somebody comes and say, what about Mother's Day? Mothers matter too. You know what? All holidays matter. To me, it's missing the point of what is being said. It's not saying that white lives don't matter. It's saying Black lives matter because based on our experience, we're not sure if everybody, I'm not sure if everybody gets that Black lives matter. So we're going to say it and we're going to keep saying it until it's heard. And whenever I hear someone say all lives matter, it makes me feel like that person doesn't get it. Because to even say all lives matter to me is saying you think the person saying Black Lives Matter thinks that your life doesn't matter. And that's insulting to me. So just the term itself triggers me to not want to have compassion for you. And that takes me out of what I'm doing, because lately it's been really hard to live by that principle, to have compassion for someone who is exhibiting that they do not have compassion for me. Enough to know that people have said what I'm saying and you are still saying it. And if you're not hearing it, you're not listening. So when someone says all lives matter, everything I just said pops up for me in a split second and pisses me off. And I don't like to be pissed off because I am a person who wants to be compassionate to all beings. And I'm up to big things and I don't have time to deal with this nonsense. So that's what all lives matters means to me.
Yeah, it is, I think, an obvious, and sorry to ask that question, but I see it a lot. And I just want to say or ask you, am I correct in assuming if you don't assert it, the opposite means that Black lives don't matter, right? That's essentially what we're talking about here. Either Black lives matter or they don't. And you're either on one side or the other.
I mean, once again, this is a nuanced conversation. To say if someone doesn't say Black Lives Matters, they're saying Black Lives don't matter. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's my perception on what's happening right now. Like, I think that anyone who stays silent or who opposes, maybe not necessarily stays silent because there could be reasons for staying silent that I'm not aware of. But for someone who is publicly opposed, I guess, to this movement, essentially, their stance is publicly saying that Black lives do not matter, because that's the opposite of Black lives matter. It's not all lives matter. It's Black lives do not matter. Right. And to me, that's just a wildly insane thing to say. And I don't think people are understanding the logical conclusions of their stances. Right. And if they did see that they would understand what the movement's about, what the movement's trying to put forward, and then hopefully be able to support it with much greater ease.
I would be very cautious to coming to that conclusion so easily, because I personally know people who have said all lives matter that through their actions show that they care about Black lives. I think it's and it's not for everybody. There are, of course, people who say all lives matter who have, who are racist, are bigoted, because there is a distinction. So I wouldn't go as far to say if you don't say a Black Lives Matter, or use the BLM hashtag, or go to a protest, or do any of these things that you have on these checklists, that you don't feel that Black Lives Matter. You could just be scared to say it, because there may be some repercussions to you, maybe from your social circles, from your business, from wherever. You may be half racist family that you live. I mean, there may be so many different things that you're not even comfortable to talk about, and your option is to not speak. Now, with that being said, it doesn't necessarily excuse you from the responsibility of taking a stance in whatever way you want. Maybe you don't want to post on social, you just want to go to a protest, or you want to, instead of purchasing dinner from this restaurant you normally go to, you want to find a Black-owned restaurant. There's so many ways you can do it without you having to use a hashtag. That's why for me, it's more about your actions, who you're being, than what you're saying. So I guess that's the wrap, to put a period on that point. I wouldn't go as far as saying if someone doesn't post Black Lives Matter or do something publicly that they feel Black lives don't matter. You would have to really know that person and know what they're doing or what they're thinking to make that conclusion.
Okay, I want to talk, if you don't mind, about kind of the connection between racial justice and the vegan movement itself. So, the vegan movement has been criticized for being a racist movement, both from inside and outside of the movement. You know, it's easy for me to have an opinion on it, but you know, I'm a white guy. So, do you feel like do you think our movement, the vegan movement, does have problems with racism? And if so, what can we do? How can we make this movement more, not just inclusive, but more focused on overall justice of all living beings?
The vegan movement is a microcosm of society in general. You have people who are racist, are bigoted, rather, and you have people who are naive. You have people who are just ignorant to what's going on. My personal experience is the same experience of just life in general. I can't point to a particular situation since I've been involved in the vegan community, and I've been involved since within the actual community, not just being vegan, because there's a difference, since 2014. So I haven't come across anything. And that's not to say it wasn't there, because a lot of times it's subversive, and it's done behind the scenes and closed doors and conversations. So I'm not going to drive myself crazy thinking, oh, was this person racist, or was this person, when they said this, did they really mean that? That's stuff I've gone through most of my life that I just kind of stopped doing because it wasn't serving me. So to answer your question, is there a problem? I would say there is a problem, because people have expressed experiences that they've gone through. Now, does that mean everybody's racist, or the majority of vegans and communities and organizations are racist? I wouldn't say that, at least from my experience. But does it exist? Of course it exists. We're living in a society where racism exists. So why wouldn't it exist?
So the racism in the vegan movement isn't necessarily like stand alone on its own. It's just part of a racist society.
Correct. Once you go vegan, it doesn't necessarily mean that you embody all of the elements of being vegan. Like for me, like in one of the, I did an interview, and I've seen you did an interview with him as well, Dr. Salesh Rao. And he said something that was mind blowing to me that I've just carried with me the whole time. Because up until that point, I thought veganism was just about your health, the environment, and the animals. But when he mentioned love and compassion, to me, it was like, yeah, that's why I'm vegan. You know, it's having compassion for other people. It's having compassion for yourself. It's having compassion for the animals. And then embodying all those other elements and characteristics, and making sure that you're aligned with your beliefs. Not to say you're perfect. You're a perfect human being. Hey, be like me. I'm vegan. That within itself is troublesome. So I kind of lost my point here, but
I see with your point about the microcosm of society, you're going to have different perspectives, just like you see different perspectives all over society. And then you're going to have a cross section of society within the vegan movement, because veganism and animal rights and environmental rights will be appealing to pretty much everyone. So you're going to have lots of different groups join a movement like that, which means you'll bring some racism in and other things that we don't necessarily want or agree with.
And it's bringing your experiences to the table, your prejudices. You know, I don't know what you've been through. And if you're truly about compassion, you know, there's a certain way we get to carry ourselves to be examples, especially if you have a platform and you're speaking up for the animals. It's not just what you do. You know, people are watching. You want people to go vegan. You know, for me, it's like I get to carry myself a certain way. Because why would I want to join something that looks like it's filled with hate?
Totally. So what about, because I've heard this a lot too, and since we're kind of comparing the two, you are a vegan, you've done a lot for animals, and you have your own group that centers around the message of spreading veganism. People are now saying that if they focus on something else, and I kind of see this throughout my life, not just right now. Right now, I guess it's more important than ever. But there's always some other social justice issue because there's so many problems in the world, right? And for those of us who have chosen to really focus on animals or veganism or animal rights, they feel like if they join another movement, even if it's very briefly, for like a brief moment in history, it will deter them from doing more for their original movement. So that is to say, if I join the Black Lives Matter movement, I will lose my energy, and therefore the animals will suffer more. You know, I'll put the animals mm-hmm. on the back burner, so to speak, because I'm now focusing on this other social justice issue.
For me, that points to a scarcity mindset, that you can't do both. And I've seen a lot of vegan organizations do that. I mean, you're doing that right now, whether you're aware of it or not. It's grounding yourself on the message of compassion and figuring out ways you can use your platform to do both. So, for example, right now, the conversation is about Black Lives Matter. It's about the Black movement, for lack of better words. As someone who has a podcast or someone who has a magazine, you can choose to spotlight Black vegans. So you can do both. You can have a conversation about what's going on, their experience, and give them a platform to share what they're up to, what they're doing for the animals, what they're doing for the movement. You don't necessarily have to say, okay, animals, I'll see you in 3 weeks once, you know, the lifespan of these things usually die down, and we'll go all in on animals. Now, what I would also like to see come out of that isn't it just be, okay, this is what's trending right now. It create a space where you're mindful of the type of guests you're booking, of the type of content you're producing. Not to say every third issue or every 10th podcast, it's now here's our Black podcast. It could be, all right, let me see if I can get Tabitha Brown on, because she's doing some really cool things for the vegan movement. I think I'm hoping that's what comes out of this. And I've worked with the school district, and that's a big part of what we do there. It's whenever I'm, you know, creating imagery for the website, or, you know, getting stock images or things like that, it's like, okay, let's make sure we have diversity, because our audience isn't just one thing. So I feel like if that could be something that comes out of everything, where people who do have these sort of platforms are just mindful about the representation that they present, I think it would be a good first step, because you might have a lot of Black people listening to you who may not be vocal, who may not be, you know, posting or what have you, but they like your vibe. They like, you know, how you guys present the thing you do. I listened to a few episodes. That was pretty cool. I like you have that consistent thing. But
that's a walrus roar.
See, there you go. I learned something new every day.
We've ever talked about it.
But hearing themselves and seeing themselves means a lot. It shows that you really care. Because, like, for me right now, honestly, since we're being open, I'm waiting for next month. God forbid another Black person doesn't get killed by an officer, but I'm waiting for next month to see where all this energy goes. Because I know that I'm going to continue showcasing not just myself. That's an easy cop out. Oh, I'm always showcasing Black people because I'm always on the show. You know, it's like, okay, I look at myself too. Like, I look at my list of podcasts, and it's like, out of the 39 episodes, I have like 5 Black people on my podcast. So it's like, okay, I get to do it for myself as well. So, yeah, that's all I got to say about that.
Well, I'll just give a quick plug then. So our next episode is going to be with Samantha Salmon, who has her own podcast about food justice, and we're going to talk about things like that, how you know, food deserts with the black within the black community and things like that, and the whole food system and holistic food system. So I'm glad you mentioned that. So I'll just giving a plug for our next month. So, but we, yeah, I think that's something.
I think the main point is that they're not mutually exclusive, right? The two social justice movements to speak up for both, and not just two. We've had, you know, Christopher Sebastian was on to talk about intersectionality and how we can talk about justice. We often say justice rather than compassion, but really it's a matter of words and definitions. But it's really justice for all. And fighting in that way, but also keeping in mind that all these different subsets, all these different categories are important, and we need to focus on them adequately and give them each representation.
Well, I'm gonna say something with what you just said. For me, I see compassion and justice as two different things.
Okay. Compassion. Great. Let's talk. This is good.
Yeah. Justice is what stops me from, justice is action for me. It's compassion and action. Compassion is my way of being. And it's not something that's easy to do. Being compassionate for someone who kills a family member isn't easy to do. But it's a principle that I ground myself on because I know what the opposite direction, going in the opposite direction, is going to do for me. So it's almost a stop plug for of me letting the toxicity of this, of what's happening in the world and society, from overwhelming me and making me do what I want to do in my heart. And by practicing it every day, it's like a muscle that if something were to happen, God forbid, to me, I'm going to be in a clear headspace where I can act accordingly and not be overtaken by my emotions and do something that could potentially ruin the rest of my life. So that's what compassion is for me. And
justice doesn't really go far enough then.
No. Justice is the next part. Justice is the next part for me not to be apathetic to just turning the other cheek. It's almost like I'm oversimplifying it, and I'm 100% clear of it. When I think of compassion versus justice at its extremes within in what I've seen, I look at like Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X. I look at being compassionate, moving with action, and I look at just focusing on the justice side of things. Now, I know that is an oversimplification of what those two people were about, because at a certain point, they crossed and had a balance of both compassion and justice, which moved to action, which moved to a change of mindset, which moved to the people's movement, which moved to Malcolm X, you know, leaving the nation. A lot of different things once you've kind of come to that come together for both of those elements. So I'm saying that because one's not better than the other. And this is the way I have it. I'm 100% open to being wrong. Somebody to, you know, reach out to me and say, listen, I heard what you had to say about compassion and justice, and, you know, you have it wrong. Okay, I'm open for that conversation. But from the way I have it, compassion is something I practice every day. Justice keeps me from being complacent when there are injustices in the world. It's me coming on this episode right now instead of just confining my thoughts to a blog article. You know, I'm putting myself at risk of misspeaking, of saying something that can potentially, you know, we live in a day and age right now where you say the wrong thing, you can get canceled. That's a whole other conversation.
Yeah. And it stays on the internet forever.
You know,
I know it's a lot of pressure sometimes, but that's part of the the problem, I guess, with speaking and you not knowing what questions we're going to ask you, right? Mm-hmm. But I guess the way that I always saw compassion was, and this is a very simplified version, I don't like cats. Ben has cats. He likes cats. I don't. But I want justice for cats. And I know that I should probably, and I like the way that you interpreted that, practice compassion for all things. You know, all animals deserve it. And I probably should have compassion for cats. And I would, if somebody was hurting a cat, I would feel bad for that cat for sure. But I really see the struggle for social justice as just a struggle for justice. And I want that cat to have the correct amount of legal rights, you know, protecting
right.
him or her.
Yeah, I see compassion as an emotion, where I see justice as morality. Mm. Right? That's kind of like, you don't have to necessarily have compassion to demand justice, to know what is right and wrong, and demand that, you know, everybody gains justice. So, all right. So tell us about SoFlo Vegans. What are you up to, SoFlo Vegans? Tell us about your podcast. We'll put it in the notes, and just want to give you an opportunity to explain what you're up to in Southern Florida.
I appreciate that. So SoFlo Vegans is an organization I founded back in 2014. We officially launched 2017. Our goal is to make South Florida a global hotspot for veganism. And my reason for doing this is I've been a native Floridian all my life. We have a running joke that it's very rare to find a native Floridian, native South Floridian, because most people either come from New York, Chicago, North Carolina, but not from South Florida. And what I see a lot is people leaving and not staking their roots in our community. So while we are one of the top vacation destinations in the world, I'm sure you've heard of South Beach, a lot of different things, our community isn't clearly identifiable. It's not easy to identify, like a Boston or somewhere else. So the reason why I created SoFlo Vegans is to use my gifts in media production and all the things that I do to showcase the region, to showcase the people, the events, all the cool things that are happening. And we do that through our website, our articles, videos that we create. We're launching a magazine, a digital magazine, and our podcast. And our podcast doesn't just simply focus on South Florida. It focuses on the vegan movement in general, because that then creates a direct pipeline to other communities to then discover South Florida. And then everything else that I mentioned, we use as ways of showcasing. So it just comes from my experience in running different communities. I've done communities in the music space and anime and manga. I say that kind of flippantly, but I really had a passion for anime and manga for a long time. And SoFlo Vegans is essentially my attempt to find a model, a sustainable model to build communities anywhere in the world. And this could extend to anything outside of veganism as well. So it's just a trial and error figuring out, okay, if I could get this, I can then speak to other communities, share what's worked for me, and then we could see veganism really start to spread in a grassroots sort of way. So while I say my mission is to make South Florida a global hotspot for veganism, that's more of a surface motivation. Beneath that is, I get to figure this out. I get to take my 24 plus years of experiences, make my mark on this world, being able to help other communities that may be figuring it out as well. So that's what SoFlo Vegans is in a nutshell.
All right. And I guess that would include Fort Lauderdale and Miami area. That's Southern Florida, right?
Yeah. South Florida is Miami-Dade, which is Miami, and a bunch of other incorporated cities. Broward County, which is Fort Lauderdale. It's probably the biggest one that you know of. And you have Parkland is also in Broward County. And then you have Palm Beach, which Palm Beach County, which right now is probably most infamous for being the home of Donald Trump and Mar-a-Lago and Jeffrey Epstein and a whole bunch of other people. So I get to change the narrative of what South Florida is as I'm saying it out loud.
I want to put you on the spot. I want to put you on the spot then. So if I'm visiting South Florida, any of those regions, give me three restaurants I got to go to.
Oh crap! You are putting me on the spot.
You can I actually heard that the first vegan food hall was from South Florida somewhere. Was it Miami? I remember seeing pictures all over Instagram about a year and a half ago.
Yeah, we had a vegan food hall. It closed down, unfortunately, but it was the V Shops in Coral Gables. So you could go there. You could have ice cream. There's a bunch of different shops set up there. It was a really cool cool experience. But for me, I would say more location wise, the new vegan is a really good spot. They have an amazing story. Guys, check it out. The new vegan that's in Del Rey, so that's the Palm Beach area. What are you doing to me here?
Miami, don't have to put you on the spot. You can think about it.
Here's the thing. Go to SoFloVegans.com.
Okay.
For cheap plug. And we have a directory of vegan restaurants in South Florida. Oh, so perfect. Those are all restaurants that I would recommend. And we're always adding new restaurants daily, so you can check that out. So that's my answer. There you go.
Okay. All right. I'll allow it.
Well, I did want to leave you with sort of the final thought here. And I first wanted to thank you for making your mark on this world. And thank you for speaking up. And thank you for joining us today on this podcast. But was there anything that we missed? And something that you really needed to discuss that you think we should be talking about? I'd like to end it with that thought.
I don't think there's anything that we missed, but what I do want to make clear is the way I see the world. And I think that's important for us to understand. Like for me, it's about starting with myself. I get to get myself, my house in order. Because I've been there. I've been in situations where I put other people first. I even put the community first. And then the moment something happens to me, the work just falls apart. And there's people who are relying on you. And it just creates more dysfunction within myself. So first things first is I get to make sure that my house is in order. Because then that puts me in a position then to help the people who are my closest circle, which are my friends and my family, and then support my community. And for me, and it's also the other part to that is using your gifts, discovering what your gifts are and sharing that. Because while you're getting yourself together, it may not be a quick thing. As you're using your gifts, those sort of things then do have an impact on the community. They do have an impact on the people that are around you. So, you know, my connection to everything and to this experience is grounding myself in my principles. It's using my gifts and it's making sure that I'm in a position to help other people. And at the core of all of it and everything that I do and everything that I practice is the principle, is the idea of being compassionate while I do that. And that's stuff that I'm always learning and always looking to improve. And having conversations like this lets me put that into action. So I want to thank both of you for having this podcast, having this safe space where I can speak freely and share what I'm up to. So thank you both so much.
Oh, thanks for coming on. This has been fantastic. And I'm sure Kevin and I have learned and hopefully I'm sure our listeners have learned a lot too. And it's been a great conversation.
Yeah, very well said. And we value the words that you said very much. And we appreciate you coming on the show. So thank you, Sean. We'll check you out on your podcast and share your links with our audience and anyone who's curious about some of the interviews with Sean, go check him out on his podcast. He's got some really great conversations there.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Sean.
And Ben, we're back. We just interviewed Sean Russell. What'd you think about that conversation?
That was a great conversation. Like it was important.
Did you feel uncomfortable?
No. Is that bad that I didn't feel uncomfortable? No, I mean, I really was like, I was hanging on his every word. And yeah. You know, when you do interviews, a lot of the time you're trying to think ahead and you're trying to prepare for, you know, your next question or the right timing or, you know, how to guide the interview. But on this one, I just kind of shut everything off and just listened. You know, I don't know Sean that well. I was just introduced to him a few days ago, but he's very compelling, and everything he was saying, I was just hanging on every word.
Yeah. Very well spoken. And there were a couple of times where I was, I guess, worried about asking certain questions.
Right.
But, you know, like I said in the beginning, I want to explore and I want to learn. And sometimes that's what it takes. It takes being a little bit uncomfortable and asking questions that you wouldn't normally ask. And I think that's what progresses all of civilization forward at a time like this when you know, this particular issue is popular and being talked about. Now is the time to ask those kinds of questions because people are receptive to those questions, and we should be more receptive to learning and to understanding perspectives.
And we, you know, it's not like you're just asking some random person on the street. You know, we have a guest on to talk about this topic. I think, yeah, it's important to, even if you are uncomfortable, to still ask those questions. And it's okay to screw up. It's okay to be wrong, as long as you're willing to learn from it. And when you do say something and someone may point out that, hey, you know what you said, that's not right, or you know, maybe it's even a little offensive, that instead of getting defensive and getting your back up and trying to justify what you said, is to just listen and learn from that experience. And you know, you may say something wrong, but this is how we learn, and then next time we know how to address it properly.
Yeah, and that was kind of the point that I was trying to explore there, that I think what it boils down to for so many people, not everyone of course, but for so many people, is the fear of being wrong, right? It's like a certain sense of being judged maybe by society as, dude, you were totally wrong. You were, you know, even worse, you were wrong and racist.
Well, that's the thing. At this point, for something like this, if you're wrong, it's also hurtful or offensive, or, you know, you can even be considered racist. But I think we, especially as white people that want to do the right thing, we have to shed that fear and just, you know, I mean, that doesn't mean that don't think about what we're saying, you know, try and use the right words, try and ask the right questions, try and say the right things. But if you do say something and someone points out, just be accepting of that and say, okay, that's my mistake. I'm going to take this as a chance to learn and grow.
Yeah. I always go to extreme examples in my head, so forgive this particular one, but I think of like a Klan member who understands at some point that racism is wrong and then denounces his Klan membership and hangs up the robes. You know, at some point that's going to be really uncomfortable and embarrassing for him to admit, but at least he did it. And we now live in a better world because he's progressed, he's evolved. I don't know anyone like that, for the record. It's not like a personal experience.
You're right, it's an extreme example. I've never met a Klan member.
But you know what I'm saying?
Right. No, I get it.
To a smaller degree. And we just admit, because we're all wrong. I'm wrong all the time. Like, we are always
Well, look at it. All vegans had to do that. Every vegan had to admit that what we were doing before was wrong and change. 99.9% of them, except that odd person that was, you know, born vegan. Right. I mean, in the future, there's going to be more of them, but, you know, I don't really know that many people, especially in our generation, that were born vegan. So we all had to do that. We all had to accept that what we were doing was wrong and to change. But people get so, they dig their heels in and say, no, I'm not racist. And then they just refuse to learn. They refuse to grow. But I think we just have to be open to, we have to recognize that we don't know everything. There's a lot more for us to learn. And we have to be willing to do that.
Yeah. I like to think about it from a historical perspective, and this helps me at least. I don't know if it'll help others. And maybe this is a bad example because there are people who believe that the earth is flat now, but if you go back hundreds of years ago, I don't know how many hundreds of years exactly, but before Columbus, I guess, it was common to think that the earth is flat. Handle that one.
Well, yes, he was morally wrong.
But like his parents did that, and everyone around him did that.
We are a product of our environment. Eventually we have to be, we have to shed our conditioning. I don't hate non-vegans. If we are, you know, to make a parallel to common times, I don't hate people that, that aren't vegan, because that's just, you know, most of our society isn't vegan. That's how they're conditioned. That's how they're indoctrinated. Does that parallel work with racism? I don't know. I mean, racism is so, it's not a social norm anymore. I mean, I guess Trump's kind of making it more of a social norm again, but it's not, I don't know. I mean, there are people that are just conditioned to be that way, but I think there's enough out there that they should know better.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what I'm trying to say. Do I make any sense?
A question though. Would you judge the caveman, the proverbial caveman who drags a woman by her hair into the cave? Would you say that he was morally wrong or just like a product of his time?
Saying someone was racist.
Yeah, there's enough evidence. There has been enough evidence for generations to like just throw that out of the water. Like we shouldn't be part of our culture at all.
But I don't know, but maybe if you live in rural Alabama or Kentucky or somewhere, maybe it's different. Maybe it is the norm to be racist. I can't speak. I've never lived in those. I've never, you know.
Well, when you say non-vegans, I think of pre-vegans, you know, that somebody made that distinction on our show at some point.
If you want to be optimistic that everyone's going to turn vegan.
Yeah, and I think, well, because that's the natural progression of things. I think our circle of whether you want to say compassion or justice will eventually include all animals. And that's just the future, you know, people are going to have to embrace it at some point. And I would make the argument for racism or anti-racism as well. So to say that someone is racist now just means that they're a pre-anti-racist. Does that make sense? They're just not there yet.
I guess. I don't use the pre-vegan term. I don't think it necessarily, well, I mean, I know it doesn't apply to everyone. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know if we're ever going to have a utopian world where everyone's vegan and not racist and non-sexist and transphobic and everything. So
you don't see the rainbow at the end of the tunnel?
I mean, I'm always going to fight for it. I'm never going to stop fighting for it, but it's just, I don't know. You're the optimistic one. I do want to say though about, and you touched on a little bit with Sean, that people that are, you know, saying, oh, we need to, you know, now that Black Lives Matter is taking over, people aren't fighting for animal rights anymore and people are ignoring veganism and we need to focus on that instead. And it's, to me, it's the fallacy of relative privation, where, you know, it's the same thing where, though, I can't go vegan because there's starving kids in Syria who really have never given a shit about before. It's just trying to find, like, I can't worry about this issue because there's something more important. But, and I'm seeing it a lot, and it's frustrating. It's pissing me off because, I mean, you know the saying, we hear it all the time where people say it takes, I don't know the exact wording, but it doesn't take anything away from a person to be kind to an animal, right? And I mean, I like to think of it as not kindness again, but justice. Doesn't take anything away from
someone to not harm animals,
just be vegan. Yeah. Doesn't take anything away. But I think that works both ways, where it doesn't take anything away from animals, non-human animals, or the vegan movement to care about human rights and racial justice too. Exactly. Right? Like you can easily not be racist and be vegan. Like it's not like if you not being racist doesn't take anything away from you fighting for animal rights.
Humans, despite what we think and despite what we see, especially as vegans, this is hard to swallow sometimes. Humans are mostly rational. Humans are mostly logical, and they are mostly compassionate and have a sense of justice. They're mostly fair to each other, right? They get that. For the most part, they're not sadistic and want to cause harm to others. I know there's tons of exceptions to what I just said, but for the most part. And so as we progress in any conversation on a societal level, it can only be good. It might be a couple of like potholes and speed bumps, and maybe we have to like reverse out of the ditch before we get back onto the highway, but we're still moving forward in the grand scheme of things. At least, I'd like to think that.
I see progress, but I want to make sure we don't get complacent.
Oh yeah.
In any movement, we can't be like, oh great. They toppled a statue of Christopher Columbus or Winston Churchill or some other historical racist. All is good now. It's better. You know, there's things happening that seem to be like they're moving in the right direction, but we can't get complacent. I mean, as Sean even said, in 38 years, it's the society he's in is just as racist now as it was when he was younger.
Yeah, that was really, really shocking.
So we need to, you know, yes, progress, but let's build on it and don't get complacent.
Yeah, for sure. At this point in time, it's the worst time to be complacent, I'd say.
Right.
Yeah.
But when it slows down, right, when it's not in the media anymore, we still need to fight for justice.
Right.
Not just because it's the hot topic.
Yeah, when I lived in Korea, that was a big thing there. It was they called it the flash in the pan. It was really, really popular for maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and then it just died away, and no one ever talked about it again. You know,
that's
lots of different issues.
That's how most social justice movements work. I mean, look at Occupy Wall Street. Where the hell did that go?
Imagine if all those people had just written an email or a letter. It would have flooded Congress.
Right.
Anyway. All right. Let's end this. Thank you guys for listening. We appreciate it. We hope that you gain some value out of conversations like this. We hope that, you know, we all learn together. And if you have any feedback for us, let us know. You know how to contact us, Facebook, Instagram, all those places. So thank you guys for listening. And Ben, as always,
live vegan.
Thank you for listening to the Live Vegan podcast.